Good morning. Excuse me, I'm very emotional today because in order to say what I want to say to you today, I had to revisit a part of my past that has never healed. So please bear with me. The real situation now is possibly the worst that it's ever been in my lifetime. And I thought as a young woman that this planet was another planet's hell realm. I, from a very protected and sheltered childhood in a suburb of Ohio, I entered the so-called real world with shock and dismay. As a young woman who I was in my early 20s and during the Vietnam War time, and I saw things then that went on that I was quite disillusioned with what I thought was the nature of humanity before then. I'd always thought that given the choice, people would always do the right thing. And I had many examples to support my hypothesis. But during those years, I saw things that made me revisit that. I saw my friends, my frightened and terrified friends, beaten by policemen who were as frightened and terrified as they were. I had friends whose dog had given birth to a litter of new puppies, and when the police came in, my friends knew their rights. They refused to let them search the house without a search warrant, so they smashed the puppies against the wall until they were dead. I had friends who had to go underground because they did terrible things in revenge. And there were students shot dead at Kent State by National Guardsmen who were in the same generation. So I've never really healed from this when I hear music from that time, or there's anything that reminds me of it. I just go back to that time. It never really healed. There's never been any intervening experiences in my life that healed that original emotional devastation. But I still, even with what I'm telling you, I think it's worse now. The presidents of that time were innocent compared to our political leaders now. They still worried about public opinion in those days. They bothered to lie to us rather than just disregard us. And this is why I think I have never felt the importance of our practice so much as I feel it now. I've never felt that it's more important to us, to people in the world, than it is now. I've never seen more reason to practice peace and love than I see now. And the love I'm talking about is a particular kind of love that is part of our Zen training, that is a result or a fruit of our Zen training. Non-specific love, the love for every atom, every cell, every muscle, every nerve fiber, every movement and amoeba that exists on the planet. I think we must practice very hard and focus our attention on our vows and to the extent that we can ground the entire human race on the planet. We need to be aware that we must keep presenting an alternative. Because I believe that right now we are engaged in a global religious war between fundamentalism and materialism. You and I have spent much of our lives developing another completely different set of values than either fundamentalism or materialism. And these values that we've been developing determine the way that we live, what's important to us, how we relate to each other, how we experience and value our natural environment, and the satisfaction that we demand from the work that we do for our livelihood. We need to keep representing and exemplifying an alternative to fundamentalism and to materialism. First, our central insight is the interdependence of all existence, the invisible endless net that connects everything, that makes us all one. That is our central insight. So the choices we make for our actions and words reflect our understanding that how we act resounds infinitely through the known and the unknown universe. Secondly, we understand that the institutions and economic systems in the world are to be judged and supported to the extent that they maximize our capacity to be whole beings, to be ecologically aware, to be ethical, to be allowed to be in a situation in which we can make an ethical choice. Respectful of other forms of life, capable of deep and intimate relationships with other humans, and assorted sentient beings, able to respond to the universe with awe and interest and curiosity. So we have allies in the non-Buddhist world, of course. I just got an email yesterday telling me that Dr. Robert Mueller, who was the former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, now Chancellor Emeritus of the University of Peace in Costa Rica, said at a talk here recently, and here's a little optimism for you. He said, this is the first time in human history that there's been a global, visible, public, viable, open dialogue and conversation about the legitimacy of war. The first time in human history. He calls this waging peace. Even while the United States is lining up missiles and sending troops and spending $1 billion a day preparing its attack, war has just been postponed for more than a year, according to Dr. Mueller. He said, before there was one superpower. He said, now there's two. The U.S. and the emerging, surging voice of the people of the world. So, I think that we should be mindful of the fact that we are forging and exemplify an alternative in this religious war. And so I'd like to talk today about what I think is the essence of Soto Zen practice and to try to fit it into our peace work. First of all, I'd like to talk about when I say the essence of Soto Zen, I mean the basic Soto Zen koan. Now, everybody's crazy about Rinzai koans, right? Moo and the sound of one hand clapping. They're so romantic. And they're so enigmatic. They're just seem so like so much fun. But the really great thing about being a Rinzai practitioner is that you get to be a certified passer of koans when you're finished. You're So you have something concrete to show for your time on the cushion. You pass move. It's very dramatic, and at least you know the moment at which it's acknowledged that you accomplished something. And then we have Soto Zen. I'm sorry. If you study Soto Zen, there's really only one koan. How do we manifest enlightenment in everything we do? It's otherwise, another way to say it is, how do we just do something? Just do it. No drama, no distraction from this. Just your everyday humdrum life. Most of us can't bear this, myself included. So what is just doing something? Have you ever tried to just do something without anything extra? Without, I'm not doing this very well, or I'm really doing this so well, or what's in this for me, or what am I going to do after I finish this? It's pretty hard to just do something. It takes years of practice. And even that's no guarantee. You might put in years of practice and then you think, well, I've put in years of practice, so now I can just do stuff. And what's the point of just doing something? Who cares? The reason you might care about this, about learning how to just do something, is that you might want to give up your whole heart something. To be completely used up by your activity with nothing left over to get neurotic about. You might want to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's the long version of just saying now. You might want to live your life fully and deeply. You might want to drop body and mind. And you might want to do no harm with your opinions and your attachments. Actually, it seems to me that it's all right to have opinions and attachments if you do no harm with them. But it gets real tricky there. And there are many Zen stories about practicing this way. A story that a friend of mine told me recently is about a tea master and a student who were preparing the tea room for the visit from the greatest tea master in Japan. And they were cleaning the room and giving up all their free time to make it absolutely pristine. And so the student said to the tea teacher, he said, well, what makes this guy the greatest tea teacher in Japan? And the teacher said, he just boils water and he just whips tea. And the student said, well, doesn't everybody just boil water and just whip tea? He said, he just whips tea. He just boils water. And you know from your own experience that this kind of wholeheartedness is very moving to observe. People talk about how Suzuki Roshi put on his sandals. If you catch a glimpse of this kind of wholeheartedness, it's very moving. It can make you dedicate your life to being as authentic and wholehearted as that gesture that you've just observed. Then another story is Bird's Nest Roshi. There's a story about a Chinese Zen master. I think his name was Zhao Lin. But he was called Bird's Nest Roshi. He got his name because he often did zazen in a tree. I know, I think that's hilarious. It would keep you awake though, right? One day an eminent man, who was both a governor and a well-known poet, paid him a visit, arriving while he was up in his tree. When the governor found him, he said, "What a dangerous feat you have up there in that tree." Bird's Nest Roshi replied, "Yours is more dangerous than mine." The governor said, "I am the governor of this province, and I don't see what danger there is in this." Bird's Nest said, "Then, sir, you don't know yourself very well. When passions burn and the mind is unsteady, this is the greatest danger." The governor then asked, "What is the teaching of Buddhism?" And Bird's Nest Roshi recited a verse from the Dhammapada, "Not to commit wrong actions, but to do all good ones, and keep the heart pure. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas." When the governor heard this, he was not impressed, and he said, "Any child of three knows that." Bird's Nest said, "Any child of three may know it, but even an 80-year-old man cannot do it." So there we have it. It's much more entertaining, given the odds against being able to do that, do no harm and do all good. It's much more entertaining to do some particular practice. We all know what the authentic life is, but can we live it? What changes would we have to make in our own life to follow the teaching of Buddhism as Bird's Nest Roshi thought? And how do we know what a good or a bad action is? How do we know? We have to train ourselves to know this even. Train some part of ourselves that makes the decision. That acts with clarity and precision. Before you understand how the interdependence, Indra's net, you can't judge a good or a bad action. Then the last one, which I really like, is case 19 of the Mumon Khan. And it's called Everyday Life is the Path. And it's an encounter between Joshu and Nansen, Nansen of the cat. So Joshu asked Nansen, "What is the path?" Nansen said, "Everyday life is the path." Joshu, "Can it be studied?" Nansen said, "If you try to study, you will be far away from it." Joshu asked, "If I do not study, how can I know it is the path?" And Nansen said, "The path does not belong to the perception world. Neither does it belong to the non-perception world. Cognition is a delusion, and non-cognition is senseless. If you want to reach the true path beyond doubt, place yourself in the same freedom as sky. You name it neither good nor not good. The same freedom as sky. Neither good nor not good." Here's a hint. In spring, hundreds of flowers. In autumn, a harvest moon. In the summer, a refreshing breeze. In winter, snow will accompany you. If useless things do not hang in your mind, any season is a good season for you. If useless things do not hang in your mind, any season is a good season for you. Just doing the same freedom as sky. If useless things do not hang in your mind, it's a good season for you. So what are useless things? Can you find useless things? Well, as you know, things aren't always useless. Some things are useless in one situation and some in another. So you have to be able to move. And one way to study this is to start noticing how we layer thoughts on top of our activity while we're doing it. Just to notice that process. Not even change it, but just notice how we layer thoughts. The favorite teaching exercise that I do with people is kind of abhidharmic, in that we directly study the skandhas in a kind of old style, analytical way, kind of pre-zen. We do walking meditation in the courtyard in a large circle, and I shout out an object of focus, the thing, the person, the object that everyone will focus on for a period of time. And people focus on that, and then I change it. And I start out with breath as an object of focus. Then the body as an object of focus. And people focus for that time, a few minutes, on their muscle and bone, if they're walking, if they're shifting their weight from one side to another. And then we get into the sense world. I ask people to focus first on what's touching their skin, then on hearing sound without labeling it, and then I ask people to look up for the first time and see things, but without seeing objects, without our conceptual predisposition, to just see color and form. So if I looked out at you right now, I would see colors and movement. I wouldn't identify you as people, or the wall as a wall. I would see color, different forms of that color. So finally, the last couple of things we do is we focus on the world of concepts and judgments. So we're trying to layer from the most basic breath all the way up to judgments. So I ask people first to pick out things they don't like, to go around the courtyard and look around, what don't you like, and then what you do like. So for the exercise, we're in the same environment for the whole exercise, doing the same activity, the walking, but we end up perceiving this from different points of view. So it's a good exercise to study the workings of your mind. And afterwards, people comment. People make comments on this exercise. And a man said to me, I can't even begin to see objects without their labels. And he was dismayed at how he not only observed his world through his ideas, but he couldn't even get free of his preconceptions to see, to just see things. And another person who had the opposite experience, she was very able to slip underneath her concepts and just see things. But she said it was so much work to judge good and bad when we had to see things we didn't like and see things we did like. She said it was so much work to do that compared to just looking at things. She said it was so completely and convincingly extra to judge everything I looked at. So extra. You might try this when you're walking down the street, to just look, not say, oh, a house, a car. Well, of course, at the curb, you want to be sure that you label cars. But then you can go back into seeing. So our perceptions are such an integral part of how we shape our world and our lives that we must study them closely to understand our participation in what happens to us. And the story goes that Buddha asked three bricklayers, what are you doing? The first one said, I'm laying bricks. The second one said, I'm making money. The third one said, I'm building a temple. So three completely different ways of looking at their activity when asked about it. Now the story doesn't say whether, after politely answering Buddha's question, they went back to carefully laying down the mortar and putting the brick just so on it, and then another brick just so on. It just doesn't say. That just ended with their answer. the story is told in such a way, as you can see, that the person whose body was building a temple is seen as a spiritually advanced person. But I think it's not necessarily so. My vote is with the guy whose body is laying bricks. But we actually don't know. All three of them could be spiritual adepts because they just answered the question. They just said what they thought they were doing. It doesn't say how they actually did the work when they returned to it. Maybe they went from building a temple to complete thorough involvement in bricks and mortar. Let's see. I think I'm going to have to eliminate. I read in the Chronicle a story of a woman who's now a Zen priest who went to a Hawaiian Zen center to do training. And instead of the rigorous physical ordeal that she thought she was going to have, she was asked to make dumplings. She was very surprised. But it turns out that in order to make good dumplings, you have to practice mindfulness and right effort very diligently. The dumpling wrappers have to be a certain texture, and the cut of the knife has to not only cut the vegetables cleanly, but the sound of the knife has to sound just right to her teacher. The knife has to come down with clarity and precision. In fact, each action involved in creating the dumplings must be so clear and focused that the eater of the dumplings is suddenly put in that mind state of clarity and focus. So this is just like boiling water and whisking tea. And this description of using a knife with an ear to its clarity implies that one way to practice just doing is to relate to objects with a sense of respect and a feeling for their individuality, awareness of that, rather than as most of us have been educated to relate to our tools, as their owners or their manipulators, their conquerors in some way, especially the natural things that we use to make things with. So we may have to learn to relearn to use our tools in a more interactive way. So think about what that means, to take your tool and see it as something, not just an extension of your hand, but see it as something with its own integrity and then to use it. I used to teach arthritics to cut carrots. This is a vegetable that hardly anyone with painful arthritis in their hands can cut. It's not like mushrooms or something like that. And the way I taught them to cut carrots was to have them feel the heft of the Japanese knife and to feel the cold stainless steel blade and then to compare that with the vulnerability of the carrots. And people could cut carrots, people who hadn't chopped vegetables for years to cut carrots. Tears came to people's eyes because they could cut carrots. And in this way, we can all be artists in our life. Our activity itself can be the fulfillment of our life, its meaning, and its joy. The movements of our fingers, our arms, our eyeballs, our legs, and our spine, the touch of our utensils, a close relationship with the tool in our hand. What an inspiration to just do. So like the emperor remarked to Bird's Nest Roshi, it sounds easy, but it's really hard to practice this way. So what would it be like just to do something without a story around it, to just do the dishes in the kitchen or answer the phones in the office or march in the march today without a story about how you're not really doing this, you're saving all sentient beings, or you're Buddhist for peace, or you're showing the world that, or the administration that, you know, they can't do this. That all may be true. But the danger of holding a story like that when you do something and making that the sole focus when you're doing something is that if you're idealistic like that, you get very discouraged if it turns out that it's not so. If your president ignores you, or the sentient beings that you're saving are very recalcitrant. They don't help you at all, save them. So, if you're focused on the doing of it, the walking to Civic Center, the expression of your heart, that's much better. Much more, you can't be discouraged, whatever the result of today's march. You'll just keep coming back and doing what you do. Just doing what you do. You can't be discouraged or turned away. So I think that, let's see, maybe we can skip that. I want to talk a little bit about, oh, I definitely want to say this. So how do you live your everyday life so that each moment, each activity is realization itself? And this is the quintessential Soto Zen koan, as I said. But actually, if you take this on, if you take this practice on, it really does look a lot like a Rinzai practitioner studying a koan. They're both samadhi practices. They both consist of bringing the koan up to yourself during all activities that you're engaged in. So you become aware of everything. While a Rinzai person might focus on a specific koan, what you do is you become aware of your direct experience. Your breath, your body sensations, your sense impressions, and the thoughts that accompany your activity. You become aware of all these layers, all this panoramic stuff that's going on while you're alive and conscious. So this panoramic attention, opening to everything without regard to your self-interest specifically, profoundly grounds us in the present moment, where phenomena flow and change and make no sense. That's one reason we don't stay in the present moment. It is really scary in there. Things don't make sense in the present moment. And Mark Epstein calls this practice shifting from a time and space reality to a breath-based reality. And time and space is, that's where craving and aversion take place, because we want stuff in time and space. In time and space, there are objects that we want or we don't want. So it's in the time and space reality where we're looking at a solid thing, and we have feelings about that solid thing. That is where craving and aversion take place. But in a breath-based reality, it's more of a flow. You don't require of reality that it makes sense. And so if you have breath-based reality in your life, sense impressions and breath dominate the landscape. Thoughts and concepts form and dissolve. They're not so hard-edged. And such a consciousness is flexible enough to hold many points of view, even paradoxes, conflicts. Hold them all. Hold them all. With ease. And when a mind can be totally aware of its conditioning and operate independently of that conditioning, then you have the freedom of the sky. The practitioner is not dependent on anything. We call this nowhere standing, the middle way. So the Soto notion of spiritual accomplishment, or of correct understanding is a little vaguer than passing a succession of koans. We don't really have any dramatic way of acknowledging the fruits of our long practice. In fact, since we emphasize everyday life as a path, we don't really acknowledge accomplishment or attainment as such. My teacher, Richard Baker, used to talk about becoming a generous person, or a person willing to be totally exposed. He used to say a 360-degree person can be looked at from any angle. And you've probably heard me talk before about the subterranean effects of practice, my belief that something like 70 to 80% of all the shifts that take place over the years of practice are unconscious. You might notice something by accident, but that's it. This is truly nothing special. The true manifestation of the koan of just doing. An example of how this works is a woman I know who's been practicing for many years at Zen Center without being formally affiliated with Zen Center. So some time ago, she approached me and told me that she wanted to deepen her practice. How could she do that? And I suggested various things, one of them studying the precepts and sewing a raksu and taking shukai, this tune. Well, she had her doubt about something that formal, but she thought she'd give it a go. So shortly after she started sewing, she came to me in a fit. She said, "The sewing is so stupid. It is so contrived. It is so nothing to do with my life." She did like studying the precepts. She thought maybe she'd like to continue that. And I said, "Fine. That's fine." And much to my surprise, then just before the end of our interview, she said, "Well, I'm going to keep sewing to see what happens." That was a surprise, but I don't know people very well, I tell you. So then she went back to the sewing room. And then the next time I saw her, she complained even more about the sewing. How silly it was. But she didn't quit. It's been months now and she's still at it. She doesn't know why she's continuing to sew. Finally, she just accepted that she is. Some other part of her has asserted itself. And she's very interesting because she's also been blindsided in a way by how deeply she's been affected by studying the precepts. Again, she would never brag about this change in her attitude because she wouldn't admit that the precepts have made any big difference to her. I mean, she wouldn't say that publicly. She's a straightforward, practical person who is not going to get involved in any of this Buddhist crap. So that's her way. So we were talking about the precepts, and she told me that something very odd had happened. And I asked what, and she said she'd been having a relationship with a man for some time, and that while he wasn't her favorite person, she didn't see any reason to end the relationship because it had a function in her life. But after she began studying the precepts, it was clear to her that she was breaking several of the precepts by maintaining this relationship. Specifically, the precept not to cloud the mind, not to misuse sexuality, not to put oneself above others, or to elevate oneself at the expense of someone else. She said she'd been confused for a long time, but now it was so clear that she had to end this relationship to maintain her own integrity. So when you look at your actions from the point of view of the precepts, a lot of useless things drop away of themselves. The precepts are the touchstone in nowhere standing. So I want to end. Oh, I'll just say just one more thing because this is important. Another student said to me that her mind in the Zendo was just like her mind at her desk, full of tasks and chores and day planning and worries about getting things done. So she's afraid she can't practice, that she's just congenitally not able to practice. I didn't know it was so widespread. But maybe the mind at her desk is Buddha's mind, and that's an easy move to the Zendo. Wu Man said, this very mind is Buddha. But in her case, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because Buddha or not Buddha, it's the only mind she's got. It's the only mind that she has to practice with. So please, after this talk, go out into the world or eat your cookie and your tea. Just do that. And today, if you march, just express yourself. Going to the march. Don't try to be for or against anything in particular. Just be there. And if a policeman or a counter-protester falls down and hurts himself, be ready to help. Thank you very much.